Welcome everyone to another episode of the Mile End Institute podcast. This week we're thrilled to be able to chat to Gavin Barwell, Conservative peer, about his book published by Atlantic called Chief of Staff, which is an account of his time spent in Downing Street with Theresa May between the summer of 2017 and the summer of 2019, when she was replaced as Conservative Party leader and Prime Minister by our current Prime Minister, Boris Johnson. Welcome, Gavin.
Thanks, Tim.
Gavin, can we start with you and something which you touch on in the book, which I find particularly fascinating, and that's your educational background. The fact that, unlike so many politicians in all parties, you went to university to study science rather than an arts or social science subject. Now, we're used to the complaint that we need more quantitatively capable and scientifically literate people in Westminster and Whitehall, and I'd agree with that. But what I found, I guess, particularly interesting is what you say, not so much about you using scientific knowledge, but about how being a science major, as no doubt they call you in the United States, actually makes you approach your everyday working, if you like, the way you approach problems in government, different to the way that many of those around you do. Could you tell our listeners something about that?
It's not something, Tim, that I'd ever thought of. And the reason I mentioned it in the book, it was something that people often asked me about. So I can think of numerous occasions where a civil servant would say to me, you know, do you have a scientific background? I was probably more than most people you find in politics, very sort of evidence-based about deciding what I thought we should do. That isn't universally the case in politics, I would say. People also say to me that when I'm arguing in a meeting, it's a very sort of structured argument that I use, that I'll sort of say, look, I think we should go with option C for the following five reasons, and then sort of run through them. It's not something I've ever really thought about, although I studied, you know, maths and physics and chemistry for A-level and natural sciences at university. I then went to work in politics really from the point at which I graduated. But it was something that increasingly people used to comment about to me. So I thought given it was of interest to them, I thought it was worth mentioning in the book.
Do you find that civil servants were a little bit more likely to do that than politicians? Or, is this canard that's often made about the civil service that they're all kind of arts graduates from Oxbridge true in your experience?
Well, they're clearly not all from that background, but I think it is probably true that you get more people from a sort of arts or social science background than from a scientific one. Nonetheless, I think the civil service does try quite hard to be evidence-driven in the policy advice that it's giving to ministers. If you think about the arguments that Dominic Cummings made about reforming the civil service, I actually had a reasonable amount of sympathy with most of them. My difference of opinion with him was purely over the means by which you go about doing it, because I think if you want to reform an institution, you have to take the people that work in it with you. So I think diversity is really important, but too often in modern life, we focus on just certain aspects of diversity. So to me, it's about ethnicity, it's about gender, but it's also about socioeconomic class. It's about the geographic spread of where people are coming from. And it's also about, you know, the kinds of subjects that they've studied and the perspectives that they bring. And you want to look at all of those things to try and make sure that the civil service is, you know, is broadly drawn in all of those regards rather than just focusing on one or two of them.
If we talk about that with regard to, you know, the political class, if you like, to MPs themselves, I mean, yeah. Do you have any sympathy with, you know, the idea that actually, in some ways, although we're getting much better in terms of gender, although it's not brilliant in some parties, actually the biggest kind of missing group, if you like, in politics at the moment is working class people?
Yeah, I had a lot of sympathy with that view. Mm. I think that we've made real strides on both gender and ethnicity. But probably if you looked at MPs now in terms of their socioeconomic background, there's not a huge difference between the Labour and the Conservative Party parliamentary parties now, I would think. You know, the Conservative Party has become less sort of upper middle class, and Labour has become less working class. And maybe the 2019 election was a step back in the right direction. I think if you look at the new Conservative MPs that have come in, there's definitely some progress on that front there. But you know, I think it's important that we look at diversity in the round.
So, I mean, coming back to you, you don't come over either in person or in the book as what one might describe as an ideologue. So why was it that you joined the Conservative Party rather than, say, thought about another political party? What was it about the Tories that appealed to you?
It's a really good question. And I think you kind of justify these things to yourself as you get older. I think that the origins of it, I had lymphatic cancer when I was a child. And the period when I'm going to give my age away now, but the period when I was going for treatment was the period in the late 70s when there was a lot of industrial action. So there were occasions when the doctor, the consultant that was in charge of my treatment, had to come and help you across picket lines to get into the hospitals. Or at least that's my sort of folk memory of it. And I remember it's one of the reasons why he ultimately left the NHS and went abroad to work. So that, obviously, as a relatively young child, I couldn't understand why that was going on. And that probably sort of attracted me a little bit I took an interest in politics when I was in my early teens, I guess. So that was probably a factor. And I think, I obviously was a child of the Cold War and the sort of arguments about the deployment of nuclear missiles in the UK and elsewhere in Europe. And that could have kind of driven you either way, right? So for some people, they thought that was wrong and that drove them to the left. But my view was that if we were under threat, we had to defend ourselves. And so that was another issue of identification. So those were probably things in my early life that made me identify with the Thatcher government. When I became an MP, and you give your maiden speech, and afterwards you're meant to listen. You listen to the speech before and the speech afterwards as a minimum. And I was listening to Lisa Nandy give her maiden speech. Her sort of attack was that the coalition government was going to drag Britain back to the 1980s. And I remember having a chat with her afterwards and saying, I was really interested in what you said, and it obviously reflects the part of the country that you grew up in. But in Croydon, where I grew up, the 1980s were probably the most prosperous period for the town that I can remember in my life. That line of attack you're using probably resonates really well in your constituency, but it's not going to resonate in other parts of the country. So, I think there's a range of reasons, I suppose, that lead to you taking one side or the other, and it would be interesting to explore that.
Did you get involved in student politics at university or not?
I'm really building a picture of myself as a nerd now, aren't I? I was involved in debating. So I wasn't involved in the Conservative Party at university, but I was involved in debating. So that's really how I sort of played out my interest in politics initially. And I was interested in taking, if you go into debating competitions and things, you don't choose which side you're on. That was a sort of really important part, that you had to be able to understand the other side of the argument and make either side.
Is the flip side of that, when you look at some of our politicians, not naming names, the tendency almost to treat the thing as a game?
Yeah, so I think I use the phrase in the book, sort of Game of Thrones, essentially. Mm. And I don't think it's just our politicians. I think bits of the media coverage of politics sometimes fall into that trap, that it's all sort of snakes and ladders, who's up, who's down, and it's not about the actual issues at stake. But the other thing that I think is important feels to me that in this sort of world of social media that we're in, lots of people have lost the ability to listen to other people. They live in an echo chamber. They follow people that share their perspective on the world. And actually, I think it's really important in politics to hear from people from different backgrounds to yourself who've got different perspectives.
Do you think your scientific training makes a difference in the sense that, if you find that empirical evidence suggests that something you previously thought was right turns out to be wrong, you find it easier to change your mind?
Yes. And I think the Conservative Party has historically, at least, whether it's true now over Brexit, but historically has had that advantage. It's been less ideological than Labour, and that's meant it's found it easier to adapt to changing circumstances. And so if you think about the post-war period, where it basically, adopted the larger state that the Labour government post-war had created and argued that it could run it more effectively than the Labour Party, I think it's, over the years, the reason for its electoral success is that it has been more adaptable.
I mean, do you think that that's also true nowadays, in the sense that I think many Conservatives would say, well, perhaps in 2010, they thought, there was a big deficit, there was a debt, something had to be done about it. But looking back on it, actually, some of those austerity policies probably did do some damage to the economy and did do some damage to public services, which in some ways needs to be put right now.
Yeah, so I think the median position in the Conservative Party was that austerity was necessary, but I don't think anyone would claim that it was without any downside. Obviously, if you're asking public services to make do with less for a period, that is going to have consequences. And there are things you can do to try and make efficiencies or whatever. But I would be very surprised if many Conservatives would say this was like completely a pain-free process. I think they would argue it was necessary in the situation we're in. And given what's happened with the pandemic subsequently, thank God that we did something to improve the public finances at that point. But the really important argument that went on during the May government, which Boris and Rishi Sunak have taken forward, was that a point has to come where you have to say, okay, you can't carry on with permanent austerity. People want to see an improvement in public services. We've taken the corrective action. Now we need to make sure we get some more money to the front line.
Now, we're here, of course, to talk about your book, and I've read it from cover to cover, and it's absolute treasure trove for someone like me who writes about the Conservative Party, writes about elections, writes about Brexit. There's so much in there, which, of course, means that I'm a little bit spoiled for choice, so we can only touch, you know, on a few things, but let's try. One of the most interesting things to me about the 3 years that followed the referendum is the way that, well, firstly, so-called soft Brexit got ruled out so quickly, and then secondly, that no deal became not so much a last recourse for some Brexiteers, but their preferred option, and indeed it became a distinct possibility for the country at one point. Now, your book charts that happening in detail, but stepping back, how and why do you think, in both cases, did that happen? And what role did Theresa May play in allowing it to happen, if you like?
So I think the first one is a more difficult one to talk about than the second, because it depends what you mean by soft Brexit. So to my mind, people talk a lot about the red lines Theresa May drew. I think there was really only one crucial one, which was saying that the free movement had to end, which meant that you couldn't stay in the single market. I get people from that side of the argument sort of berate me constantly about this. So just to be clear, I campaigned for Remain and I regret the fact that we are no longer in the single market. But I don't believe, and Theresa didn't believe, that a form of Brexit that had us still in the single market, still in the customs union, which would have meant a fisheries agreement, and presumably people would also have wanted some kind of security cooperation, I don't think that form of Brexit would ever have been acceptable as a compromise, because it basically would have meant staying in the EU apart from legally not being in the EU and not having the votes around the table. You would have found it very difficult to point to anything fundamental that had changed. Whilst I understand why people wanted to stay in the single market, having campaigned for it myself, I think she was right to draw that red line. And this is the problem with the term soft Brexit and hard Brexit. People mean them to mean different things. But to me, a soft Brexit was one that tried to avoid borders going up for goods when we move goods between the UK and the EU. Kind of checkers deal that Theresa was pursuing was, she would hate this term, but by my definition, it was a kind of softish Brexit. Whereas what we've ended up with, an FTA relationship other than for Northern Ireland, is not. Your second point was about no deal. And there, I think the picture is much more clear, which is that I think once it became apparent to some Brexiteers that the EU was not going to offer them what they wanted, which was a Canada-style deal for the whole of the UK, a group of them decided the only answer was to make a clean break and have a no-deal exit. Now, it wasn't a very large group. There was definitely a group that took that view. And that then got a lot bigger once we got close to the 29th of March. There were probably just over half the Tory parliamentary party faced with a choice between extending or leaving without a deal, would have preferred to leave without a deal because of the political price they thought they would pay for extending.
And I mean, what role do you think Theresa May had in that, in the sense that, you know, she started using the rhetoric of no deal, you know, is better than a bad deal? I mean, do you think that to some extent legitimated that kind of thinking? It encouraged people to think that it was a distinct possibility when perhaps she should have almost never have uttered that particular phrase and never given anybody the idea that it was a possibility, even a remote possibility.
So I think it's very difficult, because if you go into a negotiation saying it's impossible that we won't reach a deal, you're in a pretty weak negotiating position. One of the things that we never really faced up to is that we weren't in a particularly strong position anyway. And people hate me saying this, but the reality is a bigger share of our GDP is based on our trade with the EU than is the case for the EU in terms of its trade with us. So it was in a stronger position. We had then started the clock running, and politically it wasn't going to be difficult for the EU to extend the deadline. That wasn't going to cause them any problems, but it was politically very difficult for us. So that further put the pressure on us. And then if you were to add to that and say, I can't contemplate any circumstances in which we wouldn't reach a deal, then, you know, you're further weakening your position. So I think she was trying to articulate the reality that she wasn't prepared to sign up to anything. If she couldn't get something that she thought was an acceptable deal, then, you know, you'd have to look at that as an option. But she was also, I think, very honest about how difficult no deal would be, at least in the short term.
And what about the argument made by some Brexit ultras, as it were, that, you know, Philip Hammond blocked spending so that actually we were never able to convince the EU that we really were prepared to go for a no deal exit. How do you handle that particular criticism?
So I think that's fairly easy to handle. I mean, first of all, we spent quite a lot on no deal preparation. So it's not true that Philip Hammond blocked any spending on preparation. What the Treasury was trying to do was work out what was a good use of public money and what wasn't. But the fundamental problems with using no deal as a sort of negotiating leverage, which is what the Brexiteers that you're referring to wanted to do, was twofold. One, it was blatantly obvious to everybody that there wasn't a majority in Parliament in favour of no deal, that Parliament would try and block no deal. And secondly, that preparing for no deal wasn't just about what the British government did. It was also about what EU governments did and the EU itself did and what businesses did. No one ever stopped to ask themselves the question, did we want businesses to fully prepare for a no deal? If you're a business and I'm saying to you, Tim, right, there's a very significant likelihood of a no deal outcome, you need to be ready for it. The logical thing for you to do in many cases was set up a European entity and move jobs over there. And if you then didn't have no deal, you ended up with a deal, those jobs probably wouldn't come back. So no one ever, you know, actually, no one is unfair. People like Michael Gove did understand that point. But the people that were simplistically saying, like, just use no deal as leverage, never really thought through what the British government would have to do, what businesses would have to do to make a reality of that, or the reality of the parliamentary arithmetic and John Bercow's personal position, which meant it wasn't a credible threat anyway.
Was one of the problems the fact that the EU looked at what was going on inside the UK and, of course, read media reports just as everyone else did and really never really saw it as a credible threat?
Yeah. They you know, they can read newspapers, they can watch the TV, they can see what's going on in front of them. The government didn't. On Brexit, the government was well short of a majority in the House of Commons. The Speaker clearly was not wholly impartial on that question, if I could put it that way. So they were under no illusion, I think, that we weren't going to be able to leave with no deal. And indeed, once Boris took over from Theresa and tried to force no deal through and to prorogue Parliament, he was unable to do it. So not only did they think that, they were right to think that.
So at least in public and in the book, I mean, you're a pretty mild-mannered and indeed well-mannered man. But throughout the text, there are more than a few flashes of frustration, if you like. For example, with those supporting what I would refer to as unicorns, like the so-called Malthouse Compromise, which didn't, excuse my French, have a cat's chance in hell, really, of persuading the EU27 to change its position. I mean, how do we explain how otherwise perfectly sane, often quite practical politicians push that kind of nonsense? And how did you keep your cool when they did?
How do we explain it? I think desperation. And I think if you're going to criticise Theresa and me, the government, you know, the May government as a whole, the one thing that I think is a fairer criticism than the red line point is, could the government have done more before it ever started the Article 50 clock to explain to people what the real choices were? What options were credible, possible options, and what things did not exist as possibilities? Mm. Because you're right, when I wrote the book, I've tried very hard to write it in a way that people who do not agree with me on Brexit could still read it and find it informative and interesting. But I'm sure there are passages where my frustration shines through. And my frustration was less with people who I didn't agree with, who were... You know, if you take Steve Baker, mm-hmm. right, Steve and I have a very different view of what's in the national interest, but Steve passionately believed in what he was doing was right for the country. And I can't be angry with someone who's elected to Parliament and stands up for what they believe in. That's what I want MPs to do, not just, you know, toe whatever the line is. That he has strong beliefs and he stands up for them. The people that frustrated me were when people were advocating things that were not credible solutions at all. And so I think it was driven, as I say, by desperation. And the desperation was partly because people on both sides of the argument were very worried about the future of the Tory party, that this thing was going to rip the Conservative Party apart permanently. And so they wanted to find a solution. And when all of the sort of possible solutions weren't going to work, then it led them to look for things that seemed attractive but actually weren't weren't based in any form of reality.
We can't discuss any of this, of course, without discussing Boris Johnson, who continually pops up in your book to make Number 10's life even more of a misery than it was already. I mean, throughout, to be honest, he comes over as not really understanding the detail and not really willing to acknowledge that the kind of Brexit he spent so much time calling for, both within and outside of the cabinet, just wasn't ever going to be on offer from the EU27. Now, obviously, I don't expect you as a Tory peer to be too critical of your party's current leader, and you're not a psychiatrist, obviously. But, I mean, how do you explain his behaviour during the 2 years you spent as chief of staff in that respect?
When I was the MP in Croydon, he was the mayor of London. I thought he was a very good mayor, and he could not have been more helpful to me personally, fighting to hold on to a marginal seat. So I owe him for that, and I was close to him. And when I took on the chief of staff job, this relationship that had been a good, close relationship became a very difficult one for exactly the reason that you say. And the way I would put it, I would use the latter of your two phrases, that you couldn't get him to acknowledge the complexity of the problem. I would draw a very sharp contrast between him and Michael Gove. You know, they had both fronted the Leave campaign. Michael understood and grappled with how do we square the circle of what the kind of Brexit that he wanted with the EU's negotiating position, and, you know, Michael being a passionate unionist and caring about the unity of the United Kingdom, essentially. I think historians will place greater weight than contemporary accounts have of the fact that the prominent Leave supporters who stayed in the May government to the end, people like Michael Gove, Liam Fox, Chris Grayling, are also passionate unionists. That's the thing that kept them there. Whereas Boris's attitude was, this whole Northern Ireland thing is a hoax. It's just a ruse by the EU to keep us in their orbit. It's not really a real thing. And once he was outside the government, he was telling people, if I become leader of the party, we won't have a Northern Ireland protocol. We'll have a withdrawal agreement that's just a free trade agreement for the whole of the UK, like Canada. It's just a question of will. If we had someone that really believed in Brexit, that's what we'd get. And you know, the record is very clear. He became prime minister. That's not what he got. That's not what he was able to negotiate. I did find that incredibly frustrating, because if the prime minister is trying to sell a really awkward, difficult compromise because primarily of the complexities of the situation in Northern Ireland, and people in the government are just saying, well, I don't accept that those complexities exist, you know, then you're in trouble.
And you note that, for example, had David Davis not resigned after the famous Chequers meeting, that Boris Johnson wouldn't have either.
Once he was on the back benches, that became the focus. If you think about the speech he made at the party conference in 2018, for example. But I think it's unfair to say that was the sole reason all along. What I say at the start of the book is that if you strip away all of the technical detail in which Brexit is mired, the fundamental difference between Boris Johnson and Theresa May is about an attitude to compromise. So Theresa's view was, the country has voted to leave, so we must leave. But 52-48 was a close result, and two of the four nations of the United Kingdom voted to remain. So we need to do it in a way that brings the country back together. And that means leaving, but maintaining a reasonably close relationship with the EU. Whereas Boris's view was, you can't compromise on Brexit. You either do it full-throatedly, full-on, break completely free of the gravitational pull of the EU, or don't bother doing it at all. It's literally impossible to compromise on this issue. And that sort of philosophical difference about whether compromise is a good or a bad thing, at least in relation to Brexit, that's the fundamental dividing line between them.
I mean, I think that's a really an interesting point. It makes me wonder whether, in some ways, you found coming in 2017 that the kind of rhetoric and the attitude that Theresa May had used before then, in some ways, made that much more difficult for her. We obviously remember the conference speech in 2016, and some of the rhetoric, you know, didn't really suggest that she did really have much sympathy with the 48% who voted to remain. Do you think she could have done a slightly better job, as it were, before you came along in that respect?
So I have a little bit of a sympathy with that argument, but I think it's important to caveat it with two things. Even the 2016 speech acknowledges that compromises are going to have to be made. So it's not totally absent, although the rhetoric is certainly more, that is, if you think about the speeches she makes about Europe, you've got the 2016 conference speech, Lancaster House, Florence, Mansion House as the sort of progression.
Yeah.
Even in the conference speech, there is a recognition that compromise is going to be required. But the other thing I think you have to give some allowance for is she had just got elected leader of the party, having campaigned for Remain. So it's not unreasonable that she felt that she needed to prove to Leave supporters that she could be trusted to deliver Brexit. I think that's understandable. And I think it's particularly understandable in the context of the leadership election that she had won. She never actually got to beat a leading Brexiteer. You know, I think if you think about a counterfactual history where either Boris doesn't drop out or Andrea Leadsom doesn't drop out, and she fights an election with the party membership against a senior Brexiteer and wins, I think she would have felt in a stronger position then to set out, well, this is how I think it needs to be done. I think you do have to give her some allowance for the circumstances she was in, having campaigned for Remain, having won the leadership in a very bizarre way where all her opponents basically sort of imploded, that she felt the need to prove to Brexiteers that she could be trusted to deliver this.
That 2016 election, leadership election, is fascinating because there's so many myths sort of grown up around that, you know, that somehow if Michael Gove hadn't knifed Boris Johnson, he would necessarily have won the leadership and that would have been better for the country if a Brexiteer had been in charge. But actually, if you look at that leadership contest in detail and you know, Theresa May's ratings with members as well as voters, actually, she had the beating of Boris Johnson as well as Andrea Leadsom. So even if the contest had gone, as it were, to full term with Boris Johnson and Theresa May in it, I suspect that Theresa May might well have won in any case.
Yeah, I think it's hard to say. I mean, she definitely would have won among the MPs. It's very difficult, isn't it, to predict with certainty how the campaign amongst the membership might have played out. But it's definitely possible, possibly even likely, that she would have won.
Yeah.
But she would have been, my key point is that had she done so, she would have been in a much stronger position, having made her case for how she wanted to pursue it against someone who presumably would have pushed for a slightly harder Brexit and won among the membership. She would have been in a much stronger position.
What about the argument that actually a leadership contest in 2016 would have been much better for the Conservative Party in that it would have revealed perhaps some of Mrs. May's weaknesses as a campaigner? What would you say to that?
The first thing I would do is I would push back on the weaknesses as a campaigner a little bit. I mean, I've seen her as a constituency campaigner, both in my own constituency and in her constituency. And she's very good at it. She's very, very good on the doorstep talking to voters. Most of this perception of her being a bad campaigner comes from the 2017 campaign, which was an unmitigated disaster. And if she was talking to you now, she would say exactly the same. Why did that happen? I think because she, for two reasons. The first is, she found herself in the position which politicians sometimes find themselves in, where she felt unable to explain why she'd called the election. Yeah. She called the election because she knew she needed a bigger majority to get Brexit through. But it would have been very difficult to say to you, well, listen, Tim, the problem is some of these Conservative MPs are not reliable. And so although I still want you to vote for them, I need a few more of them to make sure I can get my deal through. That would have been a very difficult argument for her to make. So instead, we had all this strong and stable leadership, which she was convinced by her advisors. I don't mean my predecessors, I mean her campaign advisors, principally Linton, Crosby. She was convinced to run that as the campaign. She wanted to run the campaign about the country that works for everyone, the first speech she gave as Prime Minister. That's what she believes. If Theresa May has a weakness, I would say it is that she's not very good at selling something that she doesn't really believe in. There are some politicians who can be told this is the line, go out and sell that line, and they can do it. She's not very good at that. When she believes in something and it's authentic, she can be very powerful communicator, but she's not very good at just following the line. And she looked deeply uncomfortable in that election campaign, and that I think is ultimately why plus the manifesto is why it went so wrong.
What do you think, you know, explains the difference between the public perception of Theresa May? I mean, to put it as worse, as a bit of a cold fish, if you like, and the woman you got to know, to like and respect. I mean, is it just a case of an introvert finding it difficult to operate in a world where extroversion is the norm, or Is it sexism, pure and simple? I mean, what explains the difference between the perception and the reality as you know it?
It's partly that she is shy, and it is partly that she had learnt through years in politics that women showing their emotions get treated differently by the media than men do. And you've read the book, so you know, but there's a story I tell near the end, which is the only real argument that we had, where if you remember the day that she announced she was standing down as leader of the Conservative Party, she gave a statement outside Downing Street and she got teary at the end of it. And when she came inside the building and I caught up with her at the just outside the cabinet room, and she immediately apologized to me for getting emotional. And I got really angry with her. I said, what the hell are you apologizing? I spent 2 years trying to encourage you to show people more of the real Theresa May. And now you're apologizing for showing the world that you're upset at having to stand down as prime minister. Like, what normal person watching the news tonight is going to think less of you as an individual because you're upset at having to stand down? And she sort of let me rant on at her for about 2 minutes. And then sort of just gently said, you wait and see, the media will use those photographs differently because I'm a woman. And she was right. But I still think of Theresa May that showed more of herself. You know, you have to kind of ignore the media and think, how are voters going to perceive this? And I think if she'd shown more of herself to the public, they would have liked what they saw.
Tough question, this one, really. I mean, did it ever occur to you? Does it ever occur to you that Theresa May was just in the wrong job? You know, there's a skill set required to be a prime minister that maybe she doesn't have, or do you think it was a case of someone who could have been the right person in the right job, but was just there at the wrong time?
So I put it more gently than you. What I would say is it's virtually impossible to find anybody that has all the skills that are required for that job. Some of the things that I would want in any prime minister, I think she possesses in abundance in terms of what's her motivation for being in politics, in terms of diligence, being across all of the detail, etc. But I think she herself would acknowledge that the thing that she found hardest about it was the sort of modern communication skills that are required. She didn't enjoy, you know, the sort of big set piece media interviews. And that is a part of the job. If I think about all the prime ministers that I've seen during my lifetime, they all have strengths and weaknesses, but it'd be very hard to find anyone that can do all of those things. But I think she would herself acknowledge that the thing that she liked least about the job and found hardest was the sort of comm side, not necessarily the political campaigning, which is what your earlier question pointed out, in terms of talking to voters, but the sort of set piece media bit of it is the thing that she liked least and found hardest.
In some ways, perhaps she could have spent a little bit more time cultivating colleagues, you know, not just in the parliamentary party more generally, but cabinet colleagues. I mean, do you think that was a problem?
Yeah, I think that's a problem for nearly all modern politicians. This is how I end the book, isn't it? I say, if I could go back and do the job again, the first thing I would say to her is spend more time with your senior colleagues. I think what's happened in politics over the course of my adult lifetime is that Parliament has become more family friendly, which overall is a good thing. But it means MPs spend less time in each other's company in the evenings than they used to. And we've had this sort of explosion of political advisors. And so now if you're Boris Johnson or Rishi Sunak, the people that you spend most of your time with are your close advisors. They're not your most senior colleagues. The way Brexit played out and all of the difficulties the May government had, what it shows is that when the chips are really down, it's your senior colleagues that ultimately you depend on. So yes, I think definitely for her, but I think it's true for any senior politician. My advice would be, one of the tricks of politics is, can you cultivate among a group of people who also ultimately want your job, a team that has a shared purpose and will work together effectively to deliver that shared purpose? And there were at least periods, if you look back to the Cameron government, I think in George Osborne, William Hague and Oliver Letwin, David had three people who were senior colleagues who fell into that category. And actually although Theresa probably wasn't as personally close to him, Home Secretary, Chancellor, Duchy of Lancaster, Cabinet Office job, and most of the time Foreign Secretary, were stable in the Cameron government.
Partisanship aside, as someone who's been, you know, quote unquote, in the room with him, as well as someone who's seen a prime minister up close as it's possible to be. I mean, how would you assess Keir Starmer as a politician and maybe even, I know this is difficult for a Conservative peer, but as a potential Prime Minister?
My experience of him, and it's important, I can't claim to be an expert on Keir Starmer. I didn't spend anything like as much time with him as I did, obviously, with senior members of the government. But if I think of my experience of him during those cross-party talks, I think you can see the pros and cons that have been visible while he's leader of the opposition, which is overall, there's one small exception in the book, but overall he had a good grip of the detail. He's clearly an intelligent man, you know, well briefed. But I think ultimately the political judgment that he made on Brexit was wrong, both for the country and for the Labour Party. He was one of the leading figures in the Labour Party who was trying to push for a second referendum. The point I make near the end of the book, if you think there were three big votes on Brexit, right, Tim, during the May government, and the first two were meaningful votes, by which I mean they were votes on both the withdrawal agreement and the future relationship. And I think you can see entirely why Labour didn't vote for them, because it had a different view about the kind of future relationship we wanted. But the third vote was just on the withdrawal agreement. I think there was one clause in that ideally Labour would like to have changed, but other than that, there was nothing in the withdrawal agreement Labour disagreed with. If they had voted with the government on that third vote, what would then have happened? We would have brought the withdrawal agreement bill through to Parliament. And as the bill went through Parliament, there would have been votes on should the future relationship include a customs union or not? Should we have a second referendum on the whole package or not? And Parliament would have separately, rather than trying to tie it up into one bundle, would have come to views on each of those questions. We would have left the EU with a deal that had a Parliament and a sort of mandate for the future relationship that had a parliamentary majority. Now, Boris Johnson would have taken over and he might well have tried to unpick that deal. But if he had, he would not have been able to call a general election saying that the Labour Party had blocked Brexit. He would have been able to argue, well, it's not the kind of Brexit that I want, but Labour would have been in a much stronger position. And I suppose my ultimate frustration is that we've ended up with an outcome that probably only about 150 of the 650 MPs in the last Parliament actually wanted, because of an unwillingness to compromise.
You don't mince your words at the end of the book, or indeed actually more recently on Twitter, about Lord Frost and Boris Johnson's conduct of policy, and particularly with regard to the Northern Ireland Protocol. What is it that you find so difficult about what they're doing? And do you think it stands a chance of working? In other words, you know, playing hardball on Northern Ireland, threatening, you know, to invoke Article 16, etc. Do you think it's going to achieve what they want it to achieve?
Do I think it's going to achieve what they want in terms of getting everything they want? No. Do I think it's pushed the EU to make some concessions? Yes, but at significant damage to crucial relationships. My problem, I suppose, with what they've done is this is exactly the kind of relationship that Theresa didn't want to have. She did not want a Northern Ireland-only protocol that created a significant border down the Irish Sea. Boris Johnson told everybody that if he was Prime Minister, we wouldn't have that. That is what we've ended up with. So that's my first problem. Then, you know, you fight an election saying you've got a great deal, oven-ready deal, and within a year and a bit, it's turned into a terrible deal that we have to tear up. It has significantly destabilised Northern Ireland. Forget for a moment the economic disruption. For the whole period that I was in Number 10, I had to deal with a world in which there was no devolved government in Northern Ireland. I got very angry about the lack of media attention to that situation. I think if there was any other part of our country that didn't have government for that length of time, it would be on the leading the news every night. What is someone going to do about this? Because it's Northern Ireland, it gets overlooked. Some kind of deal is done between the UK and the EU, which is a compromise between the government's command paper and what the EU has offered. The danger is it's not enough for the DUP, and that you have permanently destabilised the devolved government in Northern Ireland. I mean, you ask the question, what is it I don't like about what they've done? There's quite a lot. The fundamental problem is that what they want from Brexit has been pursued without thought to what the implications for Northern Ireland would be. It's what Theresa warned about all along.
You know, you're in the Lords now rather than in the Commons. What is it you miss about that part of Parliament that you don't get being in the part of Parliament that you sit in?
I don't spend a lot of time in the Lords, if I'm honest. And I don't particularly miss my former life at the moment. I'm not the kind of person who pines for what you had before. I mean, being the MP for your hometown and getting the opportunity to serve as Chief of Staff to the Prime Minister were amazing opportunities. I will always treasure the fact that I had those opportunities, even if the Chief of Staff thing was during a really difficult period where you couldn't focus as much as you'd have wanted to on some of the domestic questions. You know, I don't find myself constantly thinking, oh, I wish I was back in number 10, or I wish I was back in the House of Commons. I'm happy with what I'm doing now and moved on to the next stage of my life.
Did writing the book produce some kind of closure and catharsis, if you like, without getting too cod psychology about it?
Writing the book was quite painful, but I'm pleased I did it. I think that whatever your views on the May government, Brexit, the whole thing, you know, it was a really important period of our politics. And I suspect people like you are going to be talking about it to your students for quite a long time to come. I hope, without being too obvious, that I've performed a little bit of a public service by giving a sort of inside account of what actually happened. And I've tried to explain what the people who I disagreed with thought, as well as saying why I thought what I did. Some of the people who, you know, mildly criticised in the book have been kind enough to privately say to me that they recognise that and appreciated it.
Well, I certainly appreciated it. And I would certainly say to anyone who hasn't read the book, do get a hold of a copy. It's called Chief of Staff, Notes from Downing Street by Gavin Barwell, published by Atlantic Books. It really is, I think, one of the best things I've read on that whole period. So genuinely, if you do get a chance to read it, really, really recommend it. So thanks very much to Gavin, and thanks very much to all of you for listening. Do follow us on social media, take a look at our website. And if you like the podcast, do give other episodes a listen, rate it and tell your friends about it. And we'll see you another time for another episode of the Mileand Institute podcast.